new year. Conference play upon us. College basketball season is essentially all the way here. If you are a college sports fan, the New Year's Six Bowls in the rearview mirror, the college football playoff semifinals in the rearview mirror, which calls for basically no college basketball on New Year's Day, unless you wanted to watch like Texas versus UT Arlington. But now we've got one game left next Monday night. That's a very light college basketball slate. But outside of that, we are full steam ahead. That means big conference slates of games on Mondays, Tuesday nights, obviously full Saturdays. It's been a lot of fun. This night, we are recording here on the 2nd. It is a Tuesday night. It's been a pretty busy day. We were recording in the midst of some games, so apologies if we get distracted or just kind of steer into results that are happening in real time. We are recording in the midst of my alma mater, Northwestern, playing against Illinois, which I guess is probably a good place to start, Brad, because it is the most noteworthy stuff we have had since the last time we recorded, which is the Terrence Shannon news at Illinois. But first off, Brad, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. How you doing?
I'm good. I mean, our last pod was on the 20th, and in the meantime, we were both at the Butler Providence game, which, it's easy to give the analytics guys some shit every now and then, but that ticket gains 3 going in has me feeling like Providence can go 15-5 and maybe win the Big East. If that 3 does not go in, I'm like crying myself to sleep. I'm praying for 11-9 to even just make the tournament. So the whole end of game luck thing, I think there is something to the analytics people with that.
That was a very fun game. It was a rare podcast meetup. Brad and I were both in the building at the Dunk or at the Amica Mutual Pavilion, the AMP. It was a great game, overtime game. Providence jumped out early. Butler battled back, really should have won the game in regulation, didn't, and then Providence just surged ahead in overtime. I will say it was very entertaining from my media seat, kind of watching Brad from a distance get like more worried and more worried as the game went on. The little like
your seats kind of suck too. Like you were on one baseline.
You get a lot of media seats on the baseline.
You have issues seeing the other end of the court?
No, I can see the other end of the court. Usually the only concern is the opposite corner with the basket stanchion. You miss a little bit of stuff. But, yeah, it's a hard life. I don't know how I do it. But, yeah, that was a lot of fun. Part of my Big East doubleheader, I went to St. John's versus UConn. And Butler and St. John's coincidentally playing as we record this podcast. So I guess we'll have more takes as we go along. But, Brad, let's get into the Terrence Shannon news to start. Still kind of learning the basketball ramifications of all of this as the Illini play as we speak. But I think I cannot really remember a situation quite like this. A team surging in the clear kind of Final Four contention. I don't know if you'd say national title, but certainly a team in the top 10 or so in the country, top 10 in KenPom. Now top 10 in the AP poll, at least they were 11th last week. Just surging all the momentum, so excited. A player that the fan base and the program has really attached itself to in Terrence Shannon. Fifth-year guy, Chicago kid, came back to home to play at Illinois, came back for a fifth year to be an All-American, to try to, get his jersey in the rafters, to try to, all the things, right? To just snap your fingers and him be suspended indefinitely and almost assuredly his college basketball career over, suspended indefinitely after a arrest on rape charges in Lawrence, Kansas. The incident supposedly allegedly occurring early in September during the same weekend as an Illinois football game in Lawrence. I have no ties to Illinois basketball. I mean, if anything, I should hate Illinois basketball, right? It's my alma mater's biggest rival. But it was hard not to read that tweet and just like immediately have your stomach kind of crawling. I mean, it was just a backbreaking piece of news in every sense of the word. you know, horrific for the potential victim or the alleged victim, horrific for Terrence Shannon's career, horrific for this Illinois team, horrific for this Illinois fan base. I mean, you get on the list. I mean, no one feels good about that moment. But your initial thoughts, Brown, a moment that will almost assuredly, you know, be felt throughout the rest of this college basketball season.
Yeah, I mean, he was probably at this point a unanimous All-American. Like, not a consensus, like a unanimous. Like, everyone who released their midseason All-American picks a day or two after, right? If they had released it before, I mean, Terrence Shannon would have been first team.
I had it written. He was on the first team, and I had to cut him.
Yeah, because, I mean, now he's not going to play the rest of the year. He wouldn't be on, you know, anyway, regardless if it were an injury or what kind of suspension it would be. Yeah, that's one of those you have to check to make sure it's not John Rothstein tweet. You know, like, how often has a first-team All-American just abruptly been swept away like that? You know, starters every now and then, but first-team All-American, potential lottery pick, it's not something you see every day.
Yeah, I mean, look, the thing that was, you know, beyond Illinois' chances and whatnot, the thing that would really kind of haunted me thinking about it was, I mean, Terrence Shannon had worked so hard to rebuild his stock, to become a potential NBA prospect, to a potential lottery pick, and was months away from changing his life, becoming a millionaire, developing generational wealth, and seemingly threw that away. And that was just, like, incredibly hard to kind of wrap your brain around. as you said, I mean, first-team All-American, Big Ten potential player of the year. Obviously, Edie would have probably had something to say about that, but certainly would have been a conversation, opportunity to get Illinois back to an Elite Eight or a Final Four. I mean, you list it. And look, I don't think Illinois is dead yet. Offensively, they're off to a hot start against Northwestern. They scored a ton of points against Fairleigh Dickinson. See that they have an incredible chemistry. They play really well together. They've defended at an elite level this year. They share the basketball. They have great positional size. But Illinois' one real mismatch this season was Terrence Shannon, right? Big physical wing, get downhill, play in transition, attack off the bounce, just ferocious driver. I mean, his speed changed games. I mean, you know, we talk about, you know, best individual skills in college basketball, right? And Zach Edey's post-up abilities, you know, strength would probably be on there. I think Terrence Shannon's speed would certainly be on there. Just his ability to cover ground on the floor was game-changing. And Illinois will miss that. You know, they have to really find different ways to manufacture offense. I do think so far so good. But I think in a lot of these circumstances, the one thing I will say, and not circumstances in, you know, lose your best player to a rape case, but circumstances of losing a best player, I think there's an initial rush of, like, everybody's stepping up, everybody's fitting in. You find ways to manufacture things, and then as the season goes on and get scouted more, it becomes harder and harder to consistently do it, right? Like, I think, like, kind of weirdly enough, like, if I was going to play Illinois, I'd want to play them in 6 weeks, not today.
Right, and you know, it's kind of interesting because Terrence Shannon was part of that Texas Tech team that, like, didn't have a point guard and that went so well. And to now be on the Illinois team, right, he, like, really showed how dynamic he was as an offensive player on, you know, multiple teams that you look at from the outside and you're like, where's their shot creation coming from? And he really stepped into that. So now without him, we'll see. If Marcus Damask and Dre Gibbs Lawhorn, everyone can keep it rolling.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to need guys to step up. Damask is not shot the ball great. They're going to need him to do that. Probably going to have to play a little bit more Dane Danger, who I don't think stylistically is really the way that Illinois wants to play, but, you know, he's just a proven big man contributor. A guy who could score the basketball. They're going to need that at times. So it'll be interesting. I'm going to go to Illinois Purdue on Friday night in Mackey. It'll be a really interesting game. Excited about that. see if Illinois can hang, but it's hard not to feel like they are, hard not to feel like some wind taken out of their sails, regardless of how they're playing early on without him.
How about staying in the Big Ten, right? Yeah. I think everyone would have had Illinois as the second best team in the Big Ten, pre the Terrence Shannon stuff. Now, you look at Wisconsin look great tonight in the late second half push against Iowa. And Michigan State, are they back to being Michigan State? I think that could still be our top four in the Big Ten. But do you have a new number two?
I don't want to grade Illinois yet. Because I would have, I think my initial reaction would have been move Illinois to four and do Purdue, Wisconsin, Michigan State, Illinois. But I think Illinois has the upside to stay at two. And I think their floor is much lower. Like, I think Ohio State could push. I've really believed that Ohio State is right there. I mean, their guard play is tremendous. Roddy Gale, I don't think people have realized the jump that he has made offensively, his ability to pass, his ability to distribute, play off 2 feet. He had 37 and 6 against West Virginia over the weekend. Has really delivered some big time performances early on this season. And I think that team's really good. And Northwestern obviously could be in that mix. But I do think Michigan State is really steadied the ship and is pushing closer and closer to being the Michigan State we saw in the preseason. Part of that is shooting regression, right? This is a better 3-point shooting team than they looked early in the season. Outside of the Baylor game, this has been winning by games, right? It's Oakland, it's Stony Brook, it's Indiana State. But Indiana State is a really legit team that pushed them, and Michigan State had the firepower. I don't think Michigan State wins that game earlier this season. And, you know, again, it's not going to be every night, but when Hogard plays well and when, you know, Malik Hall plays well, that team is going to be a tough out. And that's kind of what we've started to see lately, right? I mean, A.J. Hogard here, the last – several games, 17 points, 4 assists, 2 turnovers against Indiana State, 12 points, 10 assists, 2 turnovers against Stony Brook, 11 points, 7 assists, 0 turnovers against Oakland, 14 points, 5 assists against Baylor. Like, that's the A.J. Hogard that this team needs, right? That's the A.J. Hogard that gives Michigan State an opportunity to play deep into March. And I do think that some of the role players have started to kind of settle in. I know Trey Holloman has been much better lately, made an impact. Even like Sissoko and Cooper have been a little bit less disastrous on the offensive end. How about Monty Sissoko? Three straight games with 6 or more points.
I mean, Michigan State still has all this weird roster stuff going on.
Did you know that's actually the first time that in his career that Monty Sissoko has 6 or more points in 3 straight games?
That is pretty crazy. Because he started off strong last year. People were, you know, raving about Tom Izzo's development of him and everything on the aircraft carrier game. But Michigan State's roster situation is still super weird, where you still have a subpar center situation. Xavier Booker still is not playing, which I was thinking about transfer destinations for him over the weekend. Maybe UConn for Xavier Booker. Jackson Kohler, someone who... in almost every other instance, I would advise to redshirt 1,000%. Now it's like, I mean, he's a scoring big. Maybe throw yourself in there. Maybe you can grab this, you know, grab the reins, not even for this year, but also moving forward as well. Jeremy Fears, who got hit with a straight bullet and is going to be out presumably for the season. Talk about a freak injury. And then the guy who everyone wrote off, Trey Holloman, everyone had already penciled him into the transfer portal. He's going to be in a massive piece moving forward. And they still have one of the best, you know, a backcourt who we raved as a, you know, what, top 5 or so in the country in the preseason. So this is still a very intriguing roster situation. Even in success as it was watching them fall out of the ranks.
Yeah, I mean, it's really going to put a lot of the onus on Trey Holloman to play these backup guard spots, because they just don't have any depth in the backcourt beyond the Walker, Hogard, Aikens trio. But now in the front court, as you said, you've got Sissoko, Cooper, Booker, Hall, Kohler. There's a lot of mouths to feed. The solution is maybe Tom Izzo playing Xavier Booker at the three. Like, well, he can stretch the floor. Just trot him out there, see what he could do.
Do you have any interesting landing spots for Xavier Booker?
He should go be a Loyola Rambler.
Loyola Chicago.
I mean, that's honestly the level he should be playing at right now.
Well, I guess it's what does he want to do? Like I said, UConn earlier, with a thought, okay, Samson Johnson's a senior. You know, UConn's had some good run with developing bigs. Xavier Booker will play the 15 minutes a game behind Samson Johnson next season and then be a starter as a junior. But if he wants to be a starter right away, then, you know, Loyola Chicago, DePaul.
That's the thing, though. There are really not that many places I can forecast Xavier Booker to, because I'm not truly sure he can play at any of them. I mean, look,
right. Like when I was thinking about Providence, right, because he played AAU with Garway, I was like, do I want Xavier Booker? Like, do I want him as the starting center next year? I don't know.
It's tricky. I mean, look, like, his talent is obvious, but I mean, like, and part of this is like Miles Rubin's really good, but like it is really hard for me to forget the game I went to last year in Indiana between Xavier Booker and Miles Rubin in January of each of their senior year. Miles Rubin is Loyola's freshman big. I tweeted about him today. He's leading the country in block rate. Miles Rubin like bodied for four quarters Xavier Booker, like destroyed him. And Miles Rubin is 6'9" and 205 pounds. Like, he's super talented. Like, I think he might be Nathan Mensah, but he's so skinny. And Xavier Booker could do anything. And, like, yes, the developmental curve is different with those types of guys. I get that. But, like, I don't know that you can feel confident. Like he's not Khalil Ware either, is I guess my point. And he'll get recruited like a Khalil Ware, but he's not Khalil Ware.
Well, I mean, the whole thing with Khalil Ware was the potential skill set. Like, even watching him in FIBA, you know, the whole knock on him was always he hasn't put it together. And now at Indiana, he has. But that's kind of why I was – when I made that first UConn, when I was looking at this over the weekend, then I was like, well, wait a second. Shouldn't he go somewhere where he could start if he wants to be like the Khalil Ware redemption? Then it was like, well, where is he gonna? who's gonna afford him that opportunity? And I guess more puzzle pieces will come loose in the portal with guys leaving who you don't expect. But staying in the Big Ten as well, you mentioned Ohio State. I watched a good portion of that West Virginia game. And I guess you could chalk up the closeness to the wacky West Virginia roster, or Jameson Battle missed a ton of wide open shots that could have put the game away early. But they just still feel like kind of a bubble team, kind of a cut below even the Michigan State, Wisconsin, Illinois group. Is that how you feel as well? Are you all in on this backcourt?
I think they're flawed. Like, I think Ohio State is like the perfect fringe top 25 team, if that makes sense. Like, they have two really dominant guards. They're kind of a questionable roster outside that. You look under the hood, they probably win that West Virginia game by more than they did. Like, analytically, they, you know, missed shots, as you said, missed free throws. Somehow shot 39% on twos, right? Like, I don't know how that happens. So, I don't know. I'm not concerned by them struggling with West Virginia. I just don't know that they quite have the gear that some of the other teams at the top of the league do.
And then on Purdue, we had talked about this today, but Jonathan Givony has now ranked Zach Edey as a lottery pick. After the whole narrative for years was kind of like hand waving him away, like that, like kind of like with Sim Bular, like, oh, he'll get a shot, but you know, he's just a big lumbering goof. He can't play in the NBA. And then it was like, oh, maybe he could be Boban, like a very specific 11th man role. But now, I mean, if they're ranking him as a lottery pick, even in this super down draft, where the draft analysts are just grasping for anyone, I mean, it's kind of this, like, I think more of kind of what Sam Vecenie was tweeting about last week, where it's like, why do we have Donovan Klingon all the way up here and Zach Edey all the way down here? And just kind of like a cognitive correction? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think it's a few things. One, it's this draft really stinks. And the more we watch, the more we, you know, the more we feel comfortable that Zach Edey's an NBA player. And will have a role and will be successful. And that's quite honestly very hard to find right now in this draft. I think that's a big part of it. I think the Klingon thing is absolutely a part of it, where Klingon's emergence hasn't quite, you know, physical emergence hasn't quite happened the way that people expected, right? Like, I think people thought he could be like Walker Kessler defensively and maybe a little more skilled. That hasn't really happened. The injury is obviously a concern now. You know, Klingon's certainly still more upside, but I think, you know, if you're sitting there and you're like, oh, you know, I can risk the 7th pick on Donovan Klingon, or I can risk the, you know, 17th pick on Zach Edey, which would I rather do? You could argue maybe Edey at 17 is the better play. But I do think people need to give Zach more credit for how much he has gotten better. Like, when you watch him get switched onto guards, he doesn't get destroyed every time. Right. In the NBA, he will not be a switch big, but he does not get destroyed if he winds up matched up. He continues to improve marginally as a rim protector. He continues to improve his footwork and ball screens. He is doing all these small things to continue to improve. His impact on the game is so enormous, even in the highest level of games against the highest level of competition. Nobody can stop him. And at some point, like, that counts for something. And I also think, to be clear, I think there was always a feeling amongst kind of the mock draft people, that being like, I mean, I say this as someone who has a personal relationship with Jeremy Wu. We talk quite a bit. We travel on the road together. I'm not going to speak for Jeremy on this podcast, but like, it's not new that like Zach Edey has a chance to be an NBA player in Jeremy Wu's mind. I think if Wu were building his own big board as a GM, he probably would have had Zach Edey as like a top 30 to 40 player in last year's draft. And top 40 in last year's draft might be top 25 in this year's. I think it has taken NBA teams a little bit longer to be convinced, and I think they're starting to come around with him, especially in a draft that, you know, there's fewer and fewer answers.
Two more Big Ten notes I wanted to touch on. First, Rutgers almost went down to Stonehill, which would have been one of the worst losses of all time, right? I mean, Stonehill looked I watched maybe like 10 minutes of the second half. Stonehill looked terrible. And they were up on Wisconsin with on Rutgers with 18 seconds left in the game. And then Derek Simpson hit a go-ahead three. The thing I'm most sure about for next season is that Rutgers is going to be like a preseason top 10 team, and they're not going to live up to expectations. They're going to maybe squeak into the tournament, maybe miss the tournament, and people are going to freak out. Maybe it could end Pikel's Rutgers tenure, who knows. But there's no way that they're going to live up to expectations. Does the fact that they're trending in the wrong direction this year change your opinion at all of Pikel or the future of the program?
No. Look, I think the answer with Steve Pikel is and has been that Steve Pikel is a really high floor, low ceiling coach. Right? Like, Steve Pikel has never had an offense rated above 70th on KenPom. And part of that's recruiting and talent, right? Like, they don't have a ton of talent this year. Derek Simpson has struggled. You know, they're reliant on guys like him to produce a lot of offense. But I also don't magically think they're going to be elite offensively next year, right? I don't think if you polled Big Ten coaches that they would say that they're scared of what Rutgers is going to run offensively. Like, there's just not a ton to it. He's an elite motivator. They play incredibly hard. They're incredibly physical. And he's a very good evaluator of talent, right? I mean, you think about all the guys he has been able to track down in the 3-star range, develop into professional basketball players, right? Not necessarily NBA players, but elite European prospects. You know, Harper, I think, is on a 2-way. Like, that's an incredibly impressive thing to do. And he has certainly built Rutgers from the studs. That being said, do I think it's likely to go super great with Ace and Dylan? I honestly don't know. Like, I don't think of him as a personality that really fits having these types of recruits, right? Like, he's closer to Mick Cronin, but he's also not going to recruit over these guys because he's not going to have the resources to do so. So I think it's going to be fascinating.
Right. So they narrowly missed the tournament last year, right? They're whatever the first team out or whatever officially they were. They were super close. This year they're not making the tournament. They're going to come in whatever 9, 10, 11. Maybe they'll be a little frisky in conference play. But they went down from 80 to 90 in T rank after the Stonehill win. The horses aren't there, right? But you look at next year, and if you can get Cliff Omori to come back and Mag to come back, you'll have Gavin Griffiths and Derek Simpson. Jamichael Davis has been a nice piece, right? So that's five guys there, plus Bailey and Harper. You got Jeremiah Williams sitting out. Maybe you get another portal guy. That team, right? So Harper, Bailey, Simpson, Amori, and Griffiths. I think that'll be a preseason, if not top 10, definitely top 20 team. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I certainly think if Omori's back, they're going to be pretty highly ranked.
Obviously, it's too soon to really pinpoint where that team finishes. I think that's a fair top 20 talent team. But if that doesn't work out, let's say Rutgers misses the tournament, that's three straight misses, and they blew it with 2-1 and done highly regarded players. So it's, I mean, it is going to be such a crucial 24-25 for Rutgers. Make or break, really.
Yeah. I will say this, just kind of a bigger picture on the Big Ten this year, with Rutgers clearly struggling, with Maryland clearly not turning things around in any substantive way. I mean, just completely swallowed up by Purdue today, scored 53 points, just couldn't generate anything offensively outside of Jameer Young. There's like a real bottom forming in the Big Ten that we haven't seen in a while, right? That team, like, Maryland's not very good. Penn State's not very good. Rutgers is not very good. And then you have
Minnesota.
Minnesota, who probably isn't any good. Iowa's 0-3 now. I think they're better than that group, but not substantially. I think Michigan, now 6-7, continuing to struggle, lost to McNeese.
I wanted to touch on Michigan next.
Yeah, that thing is like quietly getting ugly. Like, their next two games, Minnesota at home, Penn State at the Palestra, are like sneaky must wins.
Well, I was listening to the Sleepers pod the other day, and they're saying Doug McDaniel, barring like a last minute grade inflation, he's going to be done for the season, which I would imagine would also end his Michigan career.
Probably, yeah.
Obviously their best player. And it's tough because, you know, they're talking about, oh, Terrace Reed's unplayable and McDaniel's come back to earth. And in my head, I still have the Michigan that ran St. John's out of the gym and looked so good early on in the year. Like, you think, oh, they're right there. They can turn it around. But it seems like this is going to be another lost season for Michigan, and probably it for Juwan.
Look, I think this is tough because it's one of those situations where everyone can kind of feel where it's going, and it's just kind of awkward to get there. I think the biggest thing that has to be said about the Juwan Howard era at Michigan, especially lately, is he is so reactive instead of proactive, right? Like, look, I mean, he has been dealt his share of misfortune, right? Doug McDaniel flunking out, if he's flunking out, would be the latest example of that misfortune, right? He had, you know, early draft decisions and, you know, just go down the list. I mean, they've had some stuff go wrong. But one, I mean, when you're the head coach, it's your responsibility to be prepared for these things. And it has never felt like they've been prepared. They weren't prepared when Caleb Houston and Musa Diabate went pro. They weren't prepared when Caleb Love just couldn't get into school. They weren't prepared when Terrence Shannon couldn't get into school, right? Like, you work your way down the list, right? How do you let the Sandersons incident leak? Like, seriously, as a head coach, how do you not have enough control of your program or respect of the people around your program not to let something like that leak? That is a terrible look for you, but likely will have no meaningful consequence, right? How do you let this Doug McDaniel thing happen, right? He's the most important player on your team. You're potentially on the hot seat. How in the world do you wind up in a position where he might be academically ineligible, right? Whether he is, isn't, whatever, whether it's all rumor, you know, da 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 da. How in the world do you let this get to this situation? And how, and by the way, right? How do you get to the world where this is like internet rumor for a week and no one's speaking on it? If Doug McDaniel is going to be out, you need to control the narrative, right? You need to explain to people how it happened. Juwan Howard has done such a poor job of doing that in every bad situation they've been in. They're 6-7 now. Goodman said it on Phil 68, like, the culture that was built under Beilein is all gone. Those players are gone. And it's just hard to look at this and see how it gets better, right? And again, maybe Michigan isn't going to fire Juwan Howard this spring. I don't know. But I think it would certainly be justified if they did. And if they don't, I don't see why you'd feel confident they're going to fix it, right? Maybe they go in the portal. Maybe they have a bunch of NIL money and they get, you know, more elite players like Olivier Conwell or whatever, but I don't know how you have any confidence in the direction of this program right now. Look, like, Michigan is projected right now on KenPom to go 13-18 this season.
Oh my God. And now in the preseason, I had them, I think, like 67-ish.
Yeah.
And then with the whole Marquette secret scrimmage and how hot they were the first 2 weeks, I was like, oh my God, are they like a top 10 team? Mm-hmm. You know, are they this year's version of Purdue from a couple of years ago? But it's not looking good. One unintended consequence of the transfer portal is how deep it is. Kind of like with the NBA draft is like, oh, you took a good player at, you know, 14th. Well, Giannis went 15th, so you're an absolute moron. And that's what's going to happen with the transfer portal here, where, you know, we saw Cooley kind of allude to it last week, where he preemptively was like, you guys better appreciate what Thad Mott is doing, right? Like with Kansas State last year, with Butler this year, and, you know, some other teams like that, you're going to point to transfer portal successes as like an easy black eye on your coach, right? Like, someone on the Providence message board even was like, you know, why the hell would Kim English not take a guy like Pierre Brooks? You know, it's like there's always going to be a better player in a different situation that you can point to kind of throw your coach under the bus. And so when, right, oh, you couldn't pivot after Caleb Love. Well, how did, you know, Butler get DJ Davis? How did St. John's get Naheem Aline and all these? You know, you can just go down the list. It's kind of a straw man argument, but people will certainly use it to further their narrative.
Look, it's work, it's intel, It's a little bit of luck. I mean, look, we had this conversation via text, Brent, the other day. And, you know, we don't have it fully fleshed out, so this is probably a better, like, off-season podcast. But I will say this. I don't think that people understand how few first-year transfers are, like, legit best players, right? It's very, very hard to build a legit team. Like really go through, like, well, let's go through the AP top 25 right now. How many of those teams, their best player is a first-year transfer, right? Like, so theoretically, you're flipping your team into getting a new best player. First-year transfer. See, Purdue's is Zach Edey. He's not. Kansas got Hunter Dickinson. We'll count him as a best player, even if McCauley's their best player. Houston, theoretically, LJ Cryer is their best player, or Jamal Shedd. So two. UConn, Tristan Newton. Tennessee, Dalton Kennett. Kentucky, certainly one of their freshmen are Reeves, so not a first-year transfer. It's not Trey Mitchell. Marquette, Kolick. North Carolina, it's RJ Davis. Illinois, it was Shannon before the, you know, incident. Arizona, like, so the top 10, there's actually a decent number, but you work your way down. Like, it's just hard. It's so hard to build a team where your best player is in the portal.
No, there was only one in the top 10, right? Or did I miss somebody?
It depended on how you were defining McCullough and LJ Cryer and Dalton Kennett versus for those teams. They're all close. Oh. And then Arizona has Caleb Love. Like, there's 20 players in the country, probably, who are best players on high majors in the portal every year. And everybody wants them. So good luck.
And I think it also speaks to how important second year transfers are.
100%.
Right. When you look at like Bayless Shireman, Tristan Newton, Devin Carter, like go up and down the list. Those guys are often even better than the star recruits, it seems. So, something to watch out for. Kind of similar, or did you have anything else on Michigan?
No, I was ready to close the book on the Big Ten if you have anything else, though.
Well, this is technically the Big Ten very soon. I want to talk Andy Enfield, who I think Steve Peichel is going to be in the Andy Enfield zone very soon. But I watched most of that Oregon game. I watched the whole first half, and I watched when USC was coming back in the second half. Oregon punched him in the mouth. USC has no cohesion whatsoever. It is like the ultimate the parts are greater than the sum of the parts are less than the whole, I guess is what I'm trying to say. They have a couple ball dominant players. There's not enough shooting. Enfield's trying to appease all the bigs. He's playing like five different bigs like a handful of minutes. And it just looks bad aesthetically, and given all the talent, I think it's frustrated USC fans to the point that they want Andy Enfield out. It seems, but I think the Andy Enfield would be closer to a Jamie Dixon than a Mark Turgeon, if that makes sense. Like that would be a pretty serious mistake to dump this guy after one bad year. After, you know, I mean, last year they were 14-6 in the Pac-12. They made 4 straight NCAA tournaments, counting the COVID canceled one, which Bracket Matrix had them as like a 9 seed. Just a victim of increased recruiting equals increased expectations.
So look, a few things on this. Number one, where USC is right now is inexcusable, right? This team is way too talented to be where they are. Their guard play is, you know, obviously incredible on paper, but in practice, you know, the shooting other than Boogie is not there. The ability for other players to make one another better is not there. The effort is not there. The interior pop is not there. Like, this team has serious flaws, and it's going to be, at this point, I think, hard to turn it around because they've accomplished nothing, right? Kansas State on neutral doesn't mean a whole lot right now. Seton Hall on a neutral doesn't mean a whole lot right now. The Oregon State loss is not going to be very good. If you run up wins here in Pac-12 play, you can probably work your way in back into the NCAA tournament conversation, but it's not going to be easy. That being said,
you need a lot of wins. You need like 14 like they did last year.
So number one, people seem to treat hiring or particularly firing coaches as punitive, right? You did a bad job, so you have to be fired, right? I'm dealing with this right now with, you know, crazy Sienna fans who want to fire Carm despite, you know, him having zero losing seasons before this year, right? You're having a bad season. You're not living up to expectations. So you need to fire the coach to punish him for having a bad season. You can't treat it that way, right? Hiring and firing coaches is not a punitive operation. It is a, what is in the best interest of the program? Like, what is the long-term interest of the program? I think it's much harder to justify saying Andy Enfield is, you know, to not say that Andy Enfield is in the best interest of USC. Second of all, I tweeted this the other day. Great coaches get better jobs, right? If Andy Enfield was making Sweet 16s and Elite Eights and Final Fours every year at USC, he would not still be at USC. He would have left and he would have gone to, you know, one of the big-time jobs that has opened here in the last 5 years. USC is a good, not great basketball job. He would have left for a great job. Bad coaches get fired, right? Fanny Enfield was going 12-20 at USC, he'd get fired. Fanny Enfield wasn't making the NCAA tournament regularly at USC, probably get fired. Good coaches, decent coaches, they stay employed for quite some time, and then everybody looks around and gets mad that everyone thinks that their coach is a bad coach because he's not a great coach, right? Andy Enfield's been to the tournament 4 times in a row at USC. USC has been to the second weekend 3 times in 50 years. Andy Enfield did that once. Like, this is not an elite job. Maybe it is now. Maybe there's resources and, you know, Southern California, like, people would be interested in that job. But USC is not like a powerhouse college basketball program. It is the fourth or fifth show in town. It is not a place that has traditionally had a lot of success. Right. And we do this with all sorts of coaches. Right. Fran McCaffrey has people up in arms at Iowa right now. Brad Brownell has been on the hot seat forever at Clemson. Right. I mean, those are obvious examples, but you can work your way through pretty much every tenured high major coach, guys who've been places 10 plus years. Most of them are victims of being not great. Right. That's why you stay. Right. Tad Boyle at Colorado would be an example of that, in my opinion. Good coach, not great, right? I mean, like there are coaches like this in every league in America, and they don't get fired because they win a lot of games, and they don't get better jobs because they don't win enough games. And I think that's where you are with any Enfield. Now, would it, you know, be advantageous to USC to start over? Some people say yes. You know, maybe if he could just leave for another job and you could hire anew, maybe you'd get somebody better. Sure, whatever. If a parachute option came about, I don't think people at USC should be like crying tears. But the idea that Andy Enfield should be like strongly on the hot seat is absolutely absurd to me.
Well, like that's the whole Mark Turgeon thing, right? Where, okay, you need a change. Okay, you can say that, but why do we think Kevin Willard is going to perform better? You just, you know, Maryland was a top 10 team during the COVID year, right? And it's like the COVID canceled season. I think Andy Enfield is even above that, where it's like, why would you need a change? Like, things are going pretty well outside of 1 year. You know, that's a stand. I mean, even now Calipari and Coach K had much higher ceilings, obviously, but they also had a stinker thrown in there. UNC did. I mean, find me the coach that doesn't have, Tony Bennett, right? Find me the coach who doesn't have a bad year.
Look, I'm open to the concept that Andy Enfield is probably underwhelmed relative to talent a lot of times. Like, I think that's true. But there seems to be a narrative that he's like a bad coach. And if he's a bad coach, then like he must be one of the best recruiters in college basketball.
So who would you want? Let's say Andy Enfield takes the parachute to like Minnesota. Who would be a coach that is realistic that would be an upgrade?
That's honestly a great question.
He's probably not going to be a sitting high major coach, you wouldn't think. So you're saying like one of the Mountain West guys?
Right, like Nico Medved doesn't scream USC.
Like Josh Schertz, Nico Medved.
Like Danny Sprinkle. Super well tied to Southern California, has won like crazy at Montana State. Won it. Like I think that'd be a fine hire. But that would be a hell of a risk.
You would lose the press conference, and there's no guarantee that he would perform better than Andy Enfield. Maybe he'd maximize a lower talent level more or something. But right, like look at Craig Smith, who I almost gave up on. Well, like Utah's very good, but obviously. He had a rolling at Utah State. The first 2 years at Utah, they weren't very good. This year, they look very good. But in like the preseason, no one looked at this roster and was like, borderline top 25 team. So like so, yeah. if you fired Andy Enfield and you hired Danny Sprinkle, are you then willing to wait 2 more years of not making the tournament? And then he gets there in year 3 or something like that?
Yeah, like it's not... I mean, look, when you perform like that, you open your door. You open the door to that. The Pac-12 is quietly in like a pretty shaky position right now.
Well, so USC and UCLA have the talent, but they're dragging. You know, like if they were to turn it around, they would drag everybody's metrics down, especially UCLA, who Mick Cronin is not happy.
He is furious, the guy who made that roster.
Yeah, he somehow thinks he has less resources than like every high major team or like Mountain West team that were able to get good transfers. Their beat writer, his name I think is Ben Bulch. I've been sending Kevin tweets because I follow this guy, and it's just Mick Cronin is just so angry. He said today. Mick Cronin said Ade Mara gave up 5 points against Oregon State faster than Cronin could go to the bathroom. Adjusting to the physicality of the college game is what Mara is battling right now. Cronin said, and his spotty minutes haven't allowed his offense to offset his bad defense. Like, we are not pulling any punches.
But, like, big picture on the Pac-12. Arizona is still really good, but have shown some kind of chinks in the armor here lately. Lost 3 of 5, you know, got handled on the road at Stanford. It was just an inferno, right? Like this is no longer like here's the best team in the country. Doesn't mean they're not good, but you know, they've regressed a little bit. USC and UCLA, like I think at best you're getting one of those teams in the tournament, but I think there's a very real chance you get neither at this point.
Probably neither. Yeah.
Those teams are going to have some intrigue in the auto bid conversation, though.
Yes, especially USC. Yeah.
Then you have Washington State's kind of turned into a pumpkin early in league play. That was like a here's an interesting metrics conversation. Stanford's not all that close to being a tournament team. That was their first high major win by beating Arizona. Cal has disappointed. Oregon State's probably better than expected, but they're still not very good. Like, you're basically, here are the potential tournament teams beyond Arizona. Colorado, probably a tournament team. Utah, playing like a tournament team, but, like, far from assured at this point. This is basically where they were last year. And then you have Washington and Oregon. Washington starts 0-2 in the league. Those are opportunities missed. Like, I think this is probably like three, maybe four.
Yeah, we'll see on Oregon because they're starting to get guys back. They look good against USC. Washington's looked okay, but already have 5 losses, lost some close games.
And Also, like, the Gonzaga thing feels a little less valuable now.
And the Xavier win is worth nothing. Right. And they lost to a bunch of Mount West teams. And sneakily, I watched a lot of, if not most, of Washington, Colorado over the weekend. Colorado was without Tristan Da Silva and Cody Williams. They were playing a guy I didn't even have on my depth charts.
Who?
Harrington or Carrington, like a white combo forward. Couldn't do much. They were like down to the – they played Eddie Lampkin the whole second half. And Washington still couldn't pull that one out.
So, yeah, I think things are a little bleak in the Pac-12. Are you concerned at all about Arizona? Beyond just like, you know, like they're just a really good team. They're not like the best team in the country.
I would have called them the best team in the country prior to what, last week, right? Because they lose to Florida Atlantic. And then the Stanford game, I did not see coming. I would have watched that game if I saw it coming. And that was like a score. You're like, oh, my God. What is going on?
Well, it's funny. Like, I saw the line come out, and I was like, you know, kind of a sleepy spot. Last year, they got, you know, completely out of nowhere, got blitzed. Maybe it happens again. And then I was like, no. Arizona's going to roll. Stanford's not any good. And I look up, and they've given up, like, 60 points in 12 minutes. And you're like, oh, Jesus.
Well, I mean, this kind of happened last year, not only with Arizona, but with all the top teams, right? We're like, at like this point last year, you're like, all right, the one seeds are Arizona, they're UConn, it's Purdue. And then these guys started dropping games. And obviously, Arizona ended up as a two seed. UConn is a four. I think a two seed feels right for Arizona. They're not going to get the quantity of wins that you'll get in the Big 12.
Right.
But I could see that just being a blip. I mean, I still love their backcourt. I love their physicality up front. Caleb Love is still playing well, right? He hasn't reverted back to UNC Caleb Love?
I don't think so.
One guy who was really terrible that who I watched over the weekend was Isaiah Collier. He was like really brutal.
I would not want to invest a number one overall pick in him, that's for sure.
No, this kind of feels a little bit like, you know, the Tyrese Maxey and Cole Anthony. Like every year there's a super highly regarded recruit who struggled in college and ends up being fine, but
yeah, like, I think he'll be fine. I worry that so many of his baskets are relying on him just, like, bullying his way to the rim.
Bronny, actually, I thought, played a good floor game.
No, I like Bronny. Bronny's fine. The problem with Bronny is, like, he's just not, like, that talented.
Yeah, he scored, like, 5 points. It was like, all right, like, he's making the right play and everything. Anything else in the Pac-12? I think they're going to get three bids, I think. I think Oregon just misses.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Maybe the most shocking result of the weekend, Notre Dame knocked the crap out of Virginia.
Well, it was funny because, you know, obviously I basically go to whichever game is best in the Chicago driving distance vicinity on any given day. And the two games that day of note were Virginia versus Notre Dame and Marquette Creighton. And all the NBA scouts and NBA evaluators were all like, we're going to Virginia, you know, you should come. And I was like, no, like, this is terrible. Notre Dame sinks. They got 20 pieces by the Citadel. Like, I can't do this. I need to go watch Marquette Creighton, even though I see Marquette all the time. This is a great college basketball game. And I get up there, and I'm like, oh, geez, like, that's a wild score. Sure, Virginia's going to make a run here soon. And then it just kept getting worse and worse. It's like, oh, my God. It is the type of result that, like, really makes you question, like, is Virginia actually talented?
I flipped it on when Notre Dame was up, like, 15 or so. And, you know, Kerry Booth is hitting threes. Marcus Burton looked incredible. Getting into the lane at will. Connection, I think, had a big game before I flipped it on. But yeah, that's the thing with Virginia is, you know, Notre Dame was hot and their offense was kind of like Andrew Rohde taking a standstill jab step three pointer, Ryan Dunn like blowing a layup, Groves with like a mid range jumper. They are missing like a serious piece. Maybe it was Kadeem Shedrick. That wouldn't help their offense a ton, but it would give them a little more athleticism. I mean, think about a Ryan Dunn, Kadeem Shedrick defensive front court. That would have been incredible.
So I was reading Virginia fan meltdowns.
Beekman was terrible too, but yeah, go on.
And one of them was basic. His take was that Virginia's problem is that Tony still wants to run the, you know, mover blocker offense, and that they have okay movers, but they don't have any blockers.
That's not wrong.
Screen. You know, they also have terrible screens, so nobody gets open because they don't have any explosive players. Because like Jacob Groves is their screener, and that, like, you know, Buchanan has not emerged. Like, Buchanan had some good games early in the season, right? Like, you think back, he played 27 minutes against Florida, he had 18 points on 18.7 rebounds, took 16 free throws in that game. You know, even like more recently, like, he played a lot of minutes against Wisconsin in the game they got blown out. Like, he has been sneaky, like, out of the rotation. He played 6 minutes against Memphis. He played 9 minutes against Notre Dame. He played 6 minutes against Texas A&M, which was a big win for Virginia. Like, he's not playing at all. So they're basically just waving the white flag on the center position because Buchanan and Jordan Minor are your two, like, traditional bigs. So now you have Dunn, who is not a very talented offensive player. You have Groves. People seem to be interested in, like, Gertrude and Leon Bond as these, like, talented young wings. But, like, those are the types of guys who average 4 and 5 points a game as freshmen. Like, those are not – this team has a bunch of guys other than Beekman and McNeely that feel like they should be averaging 4 points a game.
Yeah. Agree 100%.
So, like, I'm worried. Like, you know, presumably they'll beat the breaks off of Louisville on Wednesday. If they don't, they'll be – a bit alarming. And you know, look, Notre Dame made a bunch of shots that they don't normally make. I mean, this team shot 11 for 23 from three. They're not going to do that a lot. But you scored 54 points. And you scored 54 points against Memphis. And you scored 41 against Wisconsin. And even against West Virginia, you scored 56 and 59 against Texas A&M.
And moving forward, you're losing Beekman, yeah. You're losing Groves, and you're almost surely losing Dunn to the NBA. And this is not a transfer haven or a newcomer haven program. It's a retention program. So
I'd like to think that Bond, Gertrude, McNeely, that kind of group, Buchanan potentially develops into a good core.
You think next year, though, you think if the starting lineup is Gertrude, McNeely, Rohde, Bond, and Buchanan, are we feeling great about that? Maybe mix in one transfer?
I don't feel great about it by any means. Yeah. But
there are a few teams like that. Like Creighton, I was kind of in on their core for next year in the preseason. But like Fred King has regressed. I hope Trout has more to his game than just spot up three pointers. Mason Miller, too bashful. Jonathan Lawson's given them literally nothing. And then most importantly, Ashworth has been largely terrible this year.
I will say, I mean, look, we've talked about this, that some of these recent recruiting classes are incredibly important because it's going to become substantially harder to backfill in the portal. Without the grad transfers starting next year, or without the COVID year seniors, who are all the grad transfers. I do think you're kind of starting to feel that. Like, you're looking at teams like, ugh. And maybe it'll just be a little bit more unpredictable, right? We've gotten somewhat used to, like, everybody having all these answers, and starting, you know, next year, the year after that. You're going to have more teams that are unproven. It's going to be, all right, what does Virginia got with these sophomores? What does, you know, Creighton have with these juniors? You know, yada, yada, yada. But, yeah, I think the programs you would have thought would be, like, pretty well set up have so far not looked fantastic.
Looking at the Big Ten teams, I thought a lot of them have really nice cores in place if guys stick together. About, you know, just kind of going through it, I was like, oh, yeah, they could use maybe one transfer. But then if like Michigan blows it up or Minnesota blows it up with a coaching change, that could change everything.
And like Ohio State early entry with like Roddy Gale.
Or like one of my favorite early portal guys I'm keeping an eye on is Zed Key, who's not starting as a fourth-year player, presumably wouldn't be starting as a fifth-year player at Ohio State. So, yeah, like looking at Creighton's roster for next year, it's like, well, they're going to need a best player and a second-best player who play the 3 and the 2. And you're like looking around, and it's like, unless we're doing like some serious fan fiction, you know, like I'm putting Kobe Johnson and I don't even know who the two guard would be, Jaden Akins or something. You know, they could be in trouble, but we'll see.
Trying to think of where else we need to get to. I will say I have an observation on the college basketball internet. Jordan Sperber might be the biggest influencer there is. No one was talking about Ali Khalifa, the BYU big man who could pass. Very nifty player, right? Like, very, very gimmicky. Doesn't really, like, do anything on the block, but just, like, is, like, an insane passer, and they're using him in these zoom actions with handoffs and, you know, cuts off, you know, back cuts off of it. You just saw nothing about it. And then all of a sudden, Jordan Sperber makes his video, and every single, like, account there is tweeting out clips of Ali Khalifa and tweeting out his assist to turnover rate. It's unbelievable.
So when he committed to BYU, I remember people saying he was skilled, but no evidence of that. And then he wasn't playing much at the start of the year, and I was like, this was a wacky transfer. But it seems like it's working out. BYU is still high up in the metrics. We'll see when they start Big 12 play.
Well, yeah, Fusini Traore had been injured.
Yeah, he got hurt in the NC State game.
Yeah, so they needed a big man to step in, and so their offense has just like been humming with Khalifa. So it'll be interesting to see what they do when Traore's back, because Traore's not going to be as easily. You don't want to play him at the 4 if you can avoid it, because they want the shooting at the 1-4 spots. But it seems like people are like into Jackson Robinson as like an NBA player, and all these guys are making threes. So
another guy I was ready to give up on. He was a reclass guy, bounced around, but
just keep letting these guys get old. You know, you never know. I will say another guy that I just like saw was doing like very sick stuff on the basketball court. I watched Utah State play Air Force today because they were playing like a day game, and I was working. I just put it on. The big kid they have, Great Osabor, is, like, unbelievable.
He didn't even start at Montana State, right?
Yeah, he was, like, their sixth man because they had Jabril Bello as, like, a starting center, and he couldn't play, like, a full-time power forward. He honestly is playing kind of like a Trace Jackson Davis role for Utah State. Just, like, incredibly active. Can really pass, gets to the free throw line, athletic. They've missed Max Agbonpolo shooting the basketball and versatility wise. They had played Max as like a power forward who could switch. And even though his numbers weren't great offensively, defensively, them being able to switch 1-4 and then potentially even 1-5 with Osabor was really valuable. And now they're playing a little bit more traditional two big with Isaac Johnson or Khalifa Sacco. But they, you know, Osabor is incredible. Ian Martinez has quietly been terrific for them. And then this fresh Mason Falslev is like really interesting, like a bigger combo guard who can really attack the rim, like sneaky, athletic, bouncy, can make a shot. So they have some good players. Like, I think Utah State might actually be legit.
And, you know, two guys who you would have penciled in, Nigel Burris, right, who was the Big Sky freshman of the year. I saw a lot of people talking him up in the preseason. He's not even in rotation, right? And then Jackson Grant, who was like a McDonald's All-American in Washington, also fringe rotation guy, it seems.
Yeah, he's completely out of the mix.
But it was the duo from Montana State and then Martinez, right? That's the big three there.
Yeah, Darius Brown, great.
Martinez, one of the head scratching transfers, because we both had him starting for Maryland.
Maryland could certainly use him right now.
Think about if you slide DHS to the three and put Martinez at the two. And then
he needed a waiver too at Utah State.
Right. We were like, he's going to sit out? Like, what's going on? But
my guess is something must have happened. I don't know the story, but I feel like something had to have happened.
This is a very late transfer, too.
Right. Like, some issue must have occurred that caused him to have to go.
Florida State losing another bye game. Curse of Primo Spears, potentially.
I mean, that is approaching, like, what are we doing here, Leonard, territory?
This has got to be the end, right?
Maybe Dennis Gates was the only thing holding Florida State's program together.
And now, you wouldn't think that they could get Dennis Gates to be the next head coach, because he just signed a contract with the big buyout, right? He's got the number one recruiting class at this point. Which is interesting. They were talking on the CBS Gary Parrish pod about, like, kind of like, why is Dennis Gates spending presumably so much money and playing time and all this capital on all these freshmen that, like, aren't crazy highly ranked? So it's going to be interesting to see if that works out, because it's not going well for Missouri this year. They're looking like 12th-ish in the SEC. And then next year, you're going to have to play a lot of these freshmen. Maybe not the bigs, but like Anwar Boateng, you're going to have to play. You know, the bench guys who they have coming back, they're pretty highly regarded, like Trent Pierce, Anthony Robinson. So. We'll see on that one.
So, just a quick score update. Illinois is all over Northwestern.
Are we sure Northwestern's like even okay, even though they got beat by Chicago State?
I mean, I think they're at least okay. I mean, they're 10-2 with a win over Purdue. It'd be hard to argue that they're not okay.
I mean, is Stanford okay? Or Seton Hall okay?
Stanford's 6-6. Look, let me put it this way. Illinois should win this game at home if they're a tournament team without Terrence Shannon. But to have 54 points and be up by 23 with 17 minutes to go, that is impressive to me. Marcus Damas, 19 points, 8 for 12. Quincy Guerrier, 11 points, 5 for 7. Just balance, toughness, and defensively, I mean, they're running you off the three-point line so well. They're forcing you into a ton of mid-range, rebounding the ball extremely well. Like, the under-the-hood stuff with Illinois is really good right now.
Well, to catch them on Friday when they play Purdue.
I'll be there.
Another score update. St. John's is up 15 on Butler. Kind of pulled away mid-second half.
Poor Butler.
It was like a really fast-paced, entertaining first half, a lot of scoring. St. John's is going to clamp down here in the second half. It's not over for Butler. I mean, they lost at Providence, at St. John's. That's not crazy. But they got to start moving the needle. I believe they have UConn at home on Friday.
They do.
that is a huge, huge game, not only for the resume, but just for the vibes, getting back on track.
Those are, again, those are the types of games that you have to be able to win, right? Because if they lose that game and they lose at Marquette, all of a sudden you're, what, 1-4 in the league? And it's, like, over?
Like, people focus too much on the early records, you know, when the schedule can break a certain way. Like, Providence starts out with 3 home games. Like, Creighton's 1-2 right now, but I think that they're going to be pretty big favorites in, like, 7 of their next 8. You know, like, it all kind of works itself out, but if you're Butler, if you win all your home games and then win the road games against DePaul and Georgetown, like, you're going to the NCAA tournament. And like we were just talking about with Washington and Pittsburgh, like, you can't let all these opportunities by.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Do you have anything else you really want to get to today?
Let's see. Let me flip through some stuff here. Arkansas getting Kenyon Menefield back is pretty big. He's been balling out and is 3 games back from that academic issue, right?
Yeah, that was like out of nowhere.
Yeah, that wasn't even like a transfer waiver. Give me all the Alabama and Texas A&M stock that people are dropping because of their ugly records. I don't think they're title contenders or anything, but
I mean, Alabama's wild. Like, Alabama's 6th in KenPom.
Yeah, and I think that both Alabama and Texas A&M, I think I can call both of them top 25 teams pretty comfortably.
So my issue with Alabama is that they can't defend, and that Grant Nelson is just not very good.
Yeah, even in the Creighton game, he wasn't super impressive. Even when they slid him down at the 5, he didn't really pop at all.
Like, they can't guard Nelson. Nelson has shot the ball really poorly, which, again, should not be a surprise. It looked like, I hate to do like a victory lap, but like I think I was pretty, like, we were pretty kind of open on this podcast, like, what we thought Grant Nelson would be. And I was pretty like, this is what Grant Nelson will have to be at this level because of like where his game is. Against high level teams, he's going to be a shooter more than anything else, and he's not that good a shooter. And that's what he is. He's putting up numbers because he's playing, when he's playing by games and he's playing in tempo and he's getting downhill. But when it really comes to impacting the game and big possessions, he's not able to do it at a high level. He's just not. And they get nothing from their centers offensively, right? Like, this group is interesting because they have Mark Sears playing like an All-American, and they have guards off of him like Griffin and Estrada who can really make shots. And even like Latrell Wrightsell is shooting 46 from 3, right? They're going to outshoot some people and win some games. But I don't know that I would think, I don't know that I would say they're a top 25 team.
Pringle, when I watch him, he like really pops, but he's not productive. And then Wagu is a foul magnet. Like, every time I watch him, he's headed to the bench with fouls. But yet Mark Sears is someone who I've loved dating back to when I watched him at Hargrave. I think he was on the team with Gabe Wisnitzer, if I'm remembering correctly.
He has been amazing this year. Basically never turns it over, gets downhill, shoots free throws, shoots an elite percentage from 2, shoots an elite percentage from 3. His top, how about this? His top 4 KenPom comps this year are Scotty Reynolds, Seth Allen from those Virginia Tech teams.
Yeah. Buzz Williams team.
Melo Trimble and Seth Curry.
Wow.
Pretty good.
Yeah. Your Colorado State Rams are on in like 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's the Lobos.
They're getting healthy, right?
Yeah, Colorado State and New Mexico both healthy. Colorado State getting at least Jalen Lake, potentially Josiah Strong back. Those guys obviously incredibly important for them defensively and on their shooting. New Mexico getting Jamal Mashburn back, which I think could be like a bit of an awkward thing to deal with early on, just because he's a bit more ball dominant. How do you deal with it with Dent? Like, House was able to coexist. I'm interested to see how Mash does, because I actually liked the look with them playing Jamal Baker as like a shooter defender at the three. So it'll be interesting. That game starting in 5 minutes as we record here. I'm excited to watch. It's gonna be a great ball game. So
are you buying any Ole Miss or South Carolina? Oh, kind of rounding out the SEC.
I mean, it's not South Carolina.
But you are Ole Miss.
Yeah, a little.
I was surprised to see South Carolina in the bracketologies. I guess it's just their one loss.
Yeah, I don't understand what they've accomplished.
They beat Virginia Tech the first week of the season, who's not, you know.
Their wins are Virginia Tech on a neutral and Grand Canyon on a neutral.
The Grand Canyon one might be better, but Virginia Tech would fit in nicely with like the middle of the pack in the Big Ten. Let's see.
I like Ole Miss better. I think Ole Miss is a real team. I think it actually started to turn a corner. Like their last three bye games, they've blown out all three. They beat Cal, despite Cal being very difficult to play against offensively. They have Murray now into the mix, and he is still getting there, but is obviously incredibly talented. They don't have to play Jamarian Sharp as many minutes, him being, one of the goofiest players in the country. So I just think the big thing with Ole Miss is like Jalen Murray being really good. I am shocked by that, right? There's certain portal guys where like I don't see it at all. Jalen Murray was like very average in the MAC.
Yeah. He's been great. I figured Austin Nunez would have had that starting spot, or not. Now that Brandon Murray's back, but no, he's been great. Yeah, the Jamarian Sharp thing has been a long pet peeve of mine. That you can't tell me that the 7'5" center is a good defender when his team's ranked on like the 200s in KenPom defense. And then the other undefeated team, James Madison. I mean, it makes me irrationally angry that they're ranked ahead of Providence. Like, the media is just like, you know what? Let's look at Providence. Let's look at James Madison. Yeah, I think we prefer this mid-major team over Providence. Because, like, it's still too early to really be going off of, like, resumes. Like, this isn't resumes. It's like you're looking at two teams, and you're just going off of vibes. And people prefer the mid-major team with two good wins from the first week of the season.
I mean, look, JMU is heading into arguably its hardest four-game stretch of the season. At Louisiana, at Southern Miss, home South Alabama, home Appalachian State. If they win all four of those, we at least have to start the conversation about what an undefeated regular season looks like. Because from there, they'll have five games left of – so at that point, they'll play 17 games. They'll have 13 left. Five of those would be against 300-plus teams, if my math is correct here. Only one of them would be against the top 150 team.
How high do we think that they get in the AP poll?
I mean, if they're undefeated in February, they're going to be like 10th.
I was going to say like 5th. We're going to look up on March 17th. It's going to be... Does a Thad Mata just get tossed? We're going to look up on March 17th. They're going to be 34-0. They're going to be 4th in the AP poll, and they're going to get like a 7th seed, and people are going to be freaking out.
It will be interesting to see how they're seeded, because I mean, part of it's like, you know, if they go undefeated versus, you know, what was that Murray State team that went like 31-2. I do think psychologically, any losses versus undefeated matters. If they somehow went undefeated, kind of think you have to give them like a top three seed. No.
Wasn't that Murray State team like a 5 seed?
I think they got a 6.
6 seed. That was Isaiah Cannon, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And one of their losses was to Tennessee State and Robert Covington in the Ohio Valley, back when they were in the Ohio Valley. I guess another mid-major take. Is it confirmed now that it was like a bad move to do what Belmont and Murray did and move up to the Missouri Valley?
What do you mean by that?
So they went from a league where they could pretty much alternate and, you know, and make the tournament every other year. Sometimes they could both make the tournament when they were both humming. To now they're in a tournament where they're on par with all the other programs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big problem is that the Valley has officially become like a one bid league. There's not a huge path to stealing that second bid.
And
it's a little better. It's a much better league. I think the biggest thing is like,
well, yeah, that's the issue.
If you go 26-4 in the Valley, you will get an at-large. If you go 26-4 in the OVC, you won't. But it's so much harder to go 26-4.
Right, you're going to go 21-10 most years. When in the past, you could have covered up an okay team by playing all these sub-300 teams in the Ohio Valley. That's also what happened to Mercer a few years before, where they were usually at the top of the A-Sun. They beat Duke in the first round. They move up to the SoCon, and they have not like cracked the top half, basically. And I remember Gary Parrish was talking about when it happened, how that wasn't smart. I remember disagreeing that, like, no, the SoCon's better. And kind of like what you just said with the Valley. Like, even if it gives you, you know, a 1 in 3, you know, like 1 every 3 or 4 years, it gets 2 bids. Well, that's better than being in a league with only 1 bid. And like, you're going up to a higher level, you're working your way up. But at the same time, you're not ever getting back to the tournament. So,
well, it's such an awkward situation where, number one, like, if you're doing the move, you can't just like be at the same level resource wise. Like, Murray State has nothing spectacular from like a resource standpoint. It's in the worst location in the league. It's basically just like relying on history to try to like win the Missouri Valley, but it's probably not going to recruit. You see, you need to get lucky and hope that it's like a continued elevation into something greater. You can't just be like, we're good, so we should be in a higher conference now and then do the same shit, I think is the way I would put it. And then obviously they've been hurt. Both have been hurt by the fact that the Valley has progressed into a one bid league in the recent years.
And I mean, I'm sure people would claim otherwise, but like, it's the same with Bryant too, where it's like, you could have destroyed the NEC. And I'm sure people would say, no, well, you couldn't get the same level of player. And it's like, that is such nonsense. Like, that a recruit would care about whether they're in the America East or the NEC.
I think they do care.
You think Earl Timberlake was like, you know what? America East, okay. NEC, no way.
I don't think Earl Timberlake did, but I think a lot of recruits do. Well, they don't care. It's the people around them care. Like, the high school coaches tell them it's a big deal to be in like the MAC versus like the
NEC.
Yeah.
Because like, a lot of it is obviously they want to brag to their friends. Like, oh, I'm playing at Alabama, I'm playing at here. But once you get to a certain point, no casual or non-basketball fan knows the difference between playing at Murray State versus Stonehill. It's all like schools I've never heard of.
Anyway, shall we wrap this thing up and go watch Colorado State versus New Mexico?
I have one last take, and it's you got to feel bad for Kobe Johnson and Seth Wilson, who went from like literally playing like as much as they could handle, and Josiah Harris, right, to like the minute that Creasa and Farrakhan and Battle came back, it was like, all right, thanks for everything, guys. We're going with all the new guys.
It is funny, like Raekwon Battle is averaging like 27 points a game. Noah Farrakhan is averaging like 17 points a game. They got Kirk Creasa back, and they're like, what, like marginally better?
Yeah, they're still gonna come in last.
It's like, it's kind of nuts.
Maybe we underrate coaching. Or maybe we just underrate David Padgett.
David Padgett did the best job of all time.
By taking a top 10 team and finishing like 45th. For playing interim coach, he should have gotten like a medal.
I still believe Louisville should hire David Padgett as their forever interim coach. 100 grand yearly retainer.
Yeah.
Just to show up whenever they need a coach. Alrighty, folks. I think that wraps us up. If Northwestern makes some miraculous comeback here in the next 30 minutes against Illinois, well, all of our analysis will look pretty stupid, but that's all right. We will see you all next week after another long week of games. Excited about it. See you all next week.